space like 2D6, so it's all the same. So what we had ended up with is an equation, which was the general form for the geodesic equation, which has a non-zero right-hand side, and I wrote it in this form. So x as a function of the parameter, of course, is the description of the geodesic. And in general, we have a non-zero right-hand side, and that's what happens when we have a general parameterization. And when we specialize to an affine parameterization, we get something which is a little bit simpler because the right-hand side is zero. So that's for an affine parameterization. And of course, those are second-order differential equations. So if you want to know the geodesic, if you want to get it explicitly, you have to solve that. And to solve it uniquely, you have to specify initial conditions on the position and the velocity, you know, all of that is standard. Okay, so one thing I want to do, you know, is to illustrate the, well, the possible advantage in using the general form when it's appropriate. And one other thing that I wanted to do before I do that is to talk about the null case. So this will take in the case where the geodesic is time-like or space-like. And what I want to talk about is the issue of you know, generalizing this to the limiting case where the speed of the observer goes to the speed of light. And it turns out that the limit is a little bit subtle, because for the light-like case, so for a light-like curve, one fundamental property of that curve is the fact that, well, the space-time distance along the curve, by virtue of the fact that it's a light-like curve, is going to be zero, which means that there's no notion of length along the curve, and which means that there's no, you know, way of obtaining the geodesic, the light-like geodesic, from a variational principle, because the only you know, class of curves you're allowed to use in the variational principle. No, that's not quite true. So you can specialize to the light-like case after the variation, but nevertheless, I mean, the notion of obtaining the geodesic equation in that case from a variational principle is a little bit clumsy. So one way I like to think about this is just to consider the light-like curve or the light-like geodesic as simply a limiting case of the time-like case. So if you have a time-like geodesic, you know, in the space-time diagrams, it more or less moves straight up ahead. But if you increase the velocity, it's, you know, it slides downwards a little bit. But then if you take a limit of that and let the velocity of the observer reach the speed of light, then you obtain as a limit the null case or the light-like case. I use those two words interchangeably. So the claim is that, well, you don't have to really redo all of the variation stuff. It comes essentially for free. But as a limiting case of the geodesic equation, you also get the light-like case. And by continuity, I mean, the limit is continuous, so you don't have to modify the equation in the limit. The only thing that changes is the fact that when you reach the limit, the distance on the curve, defined in the space-time sense, is actually zero. There's one subtlety that's important, though, because when I talk about taking the limit of the geodesic equation to the null case, I'm thinking of taking the limit of the first equation, because there's no way I can take the limit of the second equation. So when we talk about, you know, so if I have, for example, the sequence of geodesic, so the first time like geodesic, the second one, the third one, and then I take a sequence that will approach to the case where the geodesic becomes null. So this is a space-time diagram where space is that way, time is that way, and space is this way. If I were to use an affine parameterization on all of those geodesics, I would be in trouble when I take the limit, because in the limit, d tau is related to the space-time distance, and in the limit, the parameter that I pick on all of those curves would become useless on this curve. So if I take the geodesic equation in its affine form, Or if I describe a geodesic in terms of affine parameterization, I don't have access to the limit where we take the speed to be the speed of light, because in that limit, the parameterization becomes singular. However, if we don't do that, if we don't choose an affine parameterization to begin with, if we pick an arbitrary normalization, then there's no issue. You can take the limit very easily. There's no obstacle in taking the limit, because in the limit, if your parameter is not an affine parameter, if your parameter is not tied to the space-time distance, if it's something else, then taking the limit is trivial. The parameter does not become singular in the limit, and there's no problem in taking the limit. So the limit of this exists in the null case. The limit of that does not. So now the question is, if you do null geodesics, are you stuck with that equation? Or is there another specialization of that equation to affine parameters that would work also for null geodesics? And the answer is that yes, you can do that. So you can, in fact, define an affine parameterization for null geodesics. The important thing to understand is that the affine parameterization of the null geodesic is not the limit of the parameterization that you would get from the time-like case or the space-like case if you approach it from the bottom. So what I'm saying here is that there exists. So even though this limit is singular, even though the limit of an affine parameter from the time-like case to the null case is singular, you can take a limit using the general parameterization. But once you have the limit, once you have the geodesic equation on this curve in terms of an arbitrary parameterization, you can actually redefine the parameter and force it to be affine. And you'll get an affine parameterization that will work for this geodesic that will not be related in any way to the affine parameters on those ones because, well, as I said, that affine parameter goes singular, goes, you know, useless in the limit. So so for null case, by a limiting procedure, we have a geodesic equation that has exactly the same form in the null case. And on top of that, once we're here, once we've taken the limit, what you can do is to actually introduce a new parameter that will be an affine parameter. So there is a transformation from the old parameter that I called lambda to a new parameter, lambda star, and lambda star is going to be an affine parameter. And I won't go through the details of this. That might actually be a problem that I'll assign to you in a little while. But I'll just tell you what the transformation is. The transformation is actually written somewhere in the notes. And let's see if I can find it. It's right here. So here you have a kappa on the right-hand side, which is a function of the old parameter. And the idea is that you can get the new parameter by integrating this differential equation right here. So the old parameter as a relation in relation to the new parameter in relation to the old parameter is an exponential. And inside the exponential, you just integrate over the kappa parameter. So I'm using lambda prime here as an integration variable. You just evaluate the integral. If you know what this is, you take the exponential, and what you get is guaranteed to be an affine parameter. So in terms of lambda star, then, if we write the equation explicitly in terms of lambda star, we have the geodesic equation in its usual form. and the important thing again. So basically, what that tells us is that you can use an affine parameterization both in a time-like and null case, but there's no relationship in the parameterization, and in particular, lambda star is not the limit of proper time. There's no relation at all between proper time on a time-like geodesic and lambda star. They're both affine parameters, but they're unrelated to each other. So I just wanted to illustrate this a little bit. So I'm going to look at this in the context of a very specific example, so that on the one hand, you might see why it might be useful and justified to look at the geodesic equation in the general form and then see what's required to take limits and things like that. So I'll just do a simple example that relates to cosmology.
Is there a physical interpretation of lambda star, or is it just a math trick?
Well, no, I don't think there's any compelling physical interpretation. The parameterization of null geodesics is always largely arbitrary. And that feature over here means that, for example, if you were, there's no notion of a length for the tangent vector. The length of a tangent vector on the null curve is always zero. Therefore, you can always rescale the tangent vector arbitrarily. And in some cases, you can rescale it in such a way that you have an affine parameterization. Sometimes you don't. So in the end, the parameterization of null geodesics or null curves in general is completely arbitrary, which means that it's pretty difficult to assign a physical or even geometric meaning to the parameter. So my attitude is, well, not to try. Sometimes the null vector that you get that would be tangent to a null geodesic is inherited from something else. For example, if you study electromagnetism in curved space time, you can introduce the geometric optics approximation, and the derivative of the phase of the electromagnetic field is something you can show will satisfy the geodesic equation and will be a null vector. In that case, there's a parameterization that's implicitly inherited from Maxwell's equations, essentially, and then you can probably say something more about this, but in more general terms than that, no. So in a sense, so short answer, I don't think there's any deep meaning to the parameterization of a null geodesic. So let's consider an example. And the point here is to try to make something which might look a little bit formal, perhaps a little bit more concrete. So I'm going to consider an example involving cosmology. So we're going to be dealing with an expanding universe, and I'll take the simplest possible. It's going to be a flat a universe with flat spatial sections. So we have a Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime, and the metric of that spacetime I'm going to write as minus dt squared plus a squared of t multiplying the flat spatial metric. So while that's the simplest spacetime that would describe an expanding universe, a is any function of time that you might wish to consider to describe the expansion of the universe. I don't care whether or not this spacetime satisfies the Einstein field equations. You can just think of a of t as some specified function, which in fact doesn't need to be specified. So we seem to have lost the McMaster people. Oh no, they're back. Okay, good. Okay, so that's the metric. So if we have the metric, we can easily calculate the Christoffel symbols or the connections. So I'll just quote the answers here. So the Christoffel symbols are as follows, and I'm writing out all the non-vanishing components. So we have those over here, which are equal to a dot over a. So a dot, of course, is the time derivative of a. And then we have those ones right here, gamma txx, gamma tyy, and gamma tzz are equal to a dot. And by the way, that reminds me of telling you something. So when I assign problems, when I invite you to work through some problems, I'll take them from the book. those problems tend to be, you know, fairly involved. And one thing that I will be assuming is that you have access to a good tensor manipulation package, for example, GR tensor working under Maple or something else working under Mathematica. If you don't have that, you'll spend all your time working through algebra and you'll make tons of mistakes and it's not worth it. So if you don't have access to a package like this, GR tensor, for example, can be downloaded for free. So take the time to install it, take the time to learn it. It's going to pay off when you work through the problems. So for example, when you calculate those Christoffel symbols, well, it's very easy to enter the metric in GR tensor and let it calculate the Christoffel symbols. And the same goes for the Riemann tensor, for example, if you might need it for a computation. So what I want to look at in this cosmology are geodesics. So I'm going to start with a time-like case, and I'm going to take those geodesics to be moving in the x direction. So in cosmology, we tend to think only about the co-moving observers, those that move at constant values of the spatial coordinates. And for those observers, the co-moving observers, t is proper time. But here I want to do something a little bit different. I want to look at a geodesic that would actually move in the x direction. So that would be a free-falling observer in the universe that's actually moving in the universe, has proper motion in the x direction. And for that observer, t is not proper time. The difference between proper time and t for a moving observer, there would be a, you know, there would be a difference that has, you know, that has to do with the velocity of the observer in the universe. So if we wanted to use a fine parameterization or proper time parameterization for our geodesics, our time-like geodesics in the expanding universe, we would not use t, we would use proper time, and proper time would be implicitly defined in terms of t, as I'm going to tell you later. The point I'm trying to make here is that while even though we might do that, and that would be a perfectly valid way of describing geodesics in an expanding universe, here we're already given a time parameter, and we might as well continue to use it. I mean, t is cosmic time, it's a well-defined physical measure of time, and because t is sort of a preferred time in an expanding universe, we might as well continue to use it, and instead of using proper time as a parameterization of time like geodesics, we might as well continue to use t. And the point is that t is going to be a good parameter, convenient parameter to use, but it's not going to be an affine parameter, as we're going to verify by doing very simple calculations. So what I'm going to consider here, first of all, are going to be time-like. Well, I'm going to be considering geodesics in general, first time-like, and then we'll take the limit of a null case. So in general, we're going to be consider geodesics moving in the x direction. And we're going to parameterize them by t and not proper time. And therefore, the description I would give to those geodesics would be something like this. So I would have to specify the position as a function of the parameter, but now the parameter has been chosen to be time. So if I want to list all the coordinates as a function of time, well, the first coordinate is time itself, so time as a function of the parameter is simply the parameter itself. And then we need to specify what x is as a function of time, and I'm assuming that it's moving only in the x direction, so y and z as a function of time are all zero. So if I know x as a function of t, I know what the geodesic actually is. So the purpose of solving the geodesic equation would be to discover what that function has to be. Okay, so how do we go about that? Well, first let's do the time-like case. Well, we can either write down the geodesic equation and try to solve that second order differential equation, or we can use all of our expertise in solving problems in mechanics and directly go back to the Lagrangian formulation. So I introduced the variational principle this morning. There are all sorts of useful tools associated with Lagrangian mechanics that perhaps we can use here. So let's go back to the Lagrangian. And the Lagrangian, that would correspond to this particular situation right here, while in general it would be minus g alpha beta, well, write it as x, I could write it as z, it doesn't matter. So the general Lagrangian is something like this, but now I can make the substitution, substitute the metric, and substitute the expressions that I would derive here for the velocities. And while here we start, so we do the double summation over alpha, and the first term that we get is 1, because the tt component of the metric is minus 1, and the t derivative of t is 1 also, so the first term is 1. Then we pick up the minus sign, the x component of the metric is a squared, and the x component of the velocity is x dot, the time derivative of x, and therefore the Lagrangian is equal to that. There are no other terms because there are no other velocity components. So we have a very simple Lagrangian, and while we know that we can reproduce the geodesic equation by just plugging this Lagrangian into the Euler-Lagrange equation in the usual way. So, hello. So one reason why I want to go back to the Lagrangian is because I notice here that the Lagrangian depends on t through the scale factor, and it depends on x dot through this factor right here, but it doesn't depend on x. And the fact that the Lagrangian does not involve x means that we have a conserved quantity. And that's always good news when you're trying to solve problems of this nature. So, so it doesn't depend on x, so the partial derivative, so the fact that the Lagrangian doesn't depend explicitly on x means that its partial derivative with respect to x dot is going to be a constant of the motion. And we can read this off. We can just do the calculation here. So I do the differentiation. I'm going to get the minus sign, which is not terribly important. I'm going to get a factor of 2 that's going to be canceled by the factor of 2 coming from the square root. So bottom line, I get from here, so I get minus sine a squared x dot divided by the square root. So I suppose I want to write this out as minus a squared x dot over the Lagrangian. And the point is that this is a constant. It's a constant that we can associate with momentum. And I'll cancel the minus sign and simply call it p. And that is a constant of the motion. So Lagrangians are good because they allow us to identify the constant of the motion. And this equation can be turned into an explicit equation for x dot. And we'll get a first order equation for x as opposed to a second order equation for x, which we would have got if we had just written down the geodesic equation. So that's certainly very handy. So I don't think I need to reproduce all of the algebra here, but you can solve for x dot, and you end up with a very explicit differential equation involving that constant of the motion, involving the scale factor, and involving, well, that square root over here. So the scale factor is supposed to be a known function, which means that this is an equation you can integrate directly. And the nice thing about this is that while this is a first order differential equation that can be integrated directly, and if you know x as a function of t, well, you have the complete description of the geodesic. And as we're going to see in just a second, if we had tried to do this involving proper time, well, we would have obtained, of course, the same curve, but the description of the curve would just be a little bit more complicated because we made the parameter a little bit more complicated. So this is, you know, how you get directly to the curve, x as a function of t, and you're expressing the curve entirely in terms of, you know, the coordinate system of your space-time. So in that sense, it's the direct way to the answer. But one thing we're also going to be verifying, you know, as we keep going, is the fact that, well, we don't have an affine parameterization here. There's a kappa that we can calculate in this case that's not going to be zero. Okay, so those boards keep going up. Okay, so how do we know about kappa? So to calculate kappa, what we have to do, of course, is to remember how it's defined. So kappa was, well, 1 over the Lagrangian times the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the parameter, which is time. So what I need to do, all I need to do here is to substitute the expression we got for x dot into the expression for Lagrangian, and then I have everything, you know, explicitly expressed as a function of the scale factor, and that allows me to take derivatives very directly. So so what I'm going to do next is to just substitute to get the Lagrangian. So substituting x dot into L, well, it's very simple algebra. I don't think I need to do it in detail. What you're going to get is that, well, expressed explicitly as a function of time, the Lagrangian becomes a over the square root of p squared plus a squared. So we know a is a function of time, we know that p is a constant, and that's a Lagrangian that we can differentiate directly. So what does that tell us then? Well, it tells us that kappa, which is defined as 1 over L dl dt in this case, well, you just do the differentiation, and you'll end up with an a dot factor and a couple of additional factors coming from the square root. You clean it up, and you end up with the following expression. It's p squared over p squared plus a squared times a dot over a. So kappa is non-zero, and therefore, you know, we're dealing with a parameterization which is not affine. That's the diagnostic for a non-affine parameterization. Why is this, you know, again, I said it before, but, you know, why is this a good choice of parameterization? Well, because, you know, the description of the geodesic comes out directly. X as a function of t is the complete description. T is a good physical measure of time, and that gives you really the simplest possible description. Let's just compare that, though, with what we would get if we, you know, had to use proper time instead, just to make the point very clear. So how do we get proper time? Well, proper time, to get it, we just go back to its definition. So proper time d tau squared, the square of proper time is minus g alpha beta. So it's minus the space-time distance. And in this case, well, it's the same calculation we did before. So we get dt squared minus a squared dx squared. So if we divide through by dt, we get that dt d tau dt squared is going to be equal to 1 minus a squared x dot squared. And the dot here I keep using to denote derivative with respect to t. So while essentially that tells me that so I can take the square root of this, and I can express the result as dt d tau, which would be 1 over the square root 1 minus a squared x dot squared. Which is probably, let's see, is that the way I wanted to leave it? No, because it's a bit clumsy the way I've left it here, because this is still a derivative with respect to t. So let's see, I think I decided to do something else here in my notes. So let's, well, let's leave it at that for now. But so let me calculate dx d tau. So dt d tau and dx d tau would be the components of the four velocity vector, which is the tangent vector that you define when you use proper time as a parameterization. So let's work it out. So dx dt would be dx d tau would be dx dt dt d tau. And this is something we've worked out. It's x dot dt d tau, which we have worked out right here. And I think, so I think the only missing thing that I didn't remember is that what I really want to do at this stage is to make the substitution. Because we've already worked this out, we can use this result and get clean expressions for dt d tau and dx d tau. So if we again substitute the expression for x dot and simplify the algebra, then we'll end up with an expression for dt d tau that will simplify to this. So it's going to be p squared plus a squared divided by a, and the x d tau would be equal to p over a squared. So you'll have to believe me that this is what you get when you work through the algebra, which is certainly not very difficult. So this is the t component of the four velocity vector. This is the x component of the four velocity vector. And the point here is that, well, if you choose to parameterize the geodesic in terms of proper time, well, there's no obstacle, we can still do that. You end up with those equations that tell you how the geodesic is behaving. And, you know, they're still pretty convenient to work with because you still have the first order form. The origin of the constant integration is something that we'll, you know, talk about a little bit later. But that's something that you could have derived, you know, by other means. So you would have concluded, discovered the existence of a constant of motion. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, well, the description that you're getting here, instead of having one simple differential equation to integrate, here you have a set of two, right? Because by introducing a third variable in the problem, you've made the equations a little bit harder. Now you have to solve for t as a function of tau, x as a function of tau, and the differential equations have a right-hand side where what appears on the right-hand side is a function of t. So it's not that difficult, you know, you can solve this numerically without any problem, but nevertheless, it's a little bit harder than it has to be, it's a little bit more involved than it has to be, whereas the description on the other side of the blackboard is much more direct, and therefore I think it makes a case for the sort of the usefulness and convenience of using a parameterization, which is not necessarily tied to proper time. Another aspect to this has to do with taking the limit. If you take the limit to the null case, those equations are completely uninformative because the limit of d tau, when you take the null case, of course, is zero, so the limit is singular. So there's no way you could, you know, discover what is the limiting case to null geodesics by looking at those equations right here. So the parameterization, as I said, is useless in the limit, whereas there's really nothing wrong with cosmic time when you start talking about particles that move with the speed of light. So taking the limit from over there is completely feasible. Taking the limit from over here is not. So let's look at that. How do we take the limit? So let's look at the null case. So what we want to do here is to take the limit where the motion of the observer reaches the speed of light. And what we want to achieve essentially is the condition that in the limit, the Lagrangian goes to zero, because the Lagrangian is the space-time distance along the curve, and we're, by taking the limit, we're making the distance zero. So here we have an expression for the Lagrangian that works for the time-like case, and we can think of trying to take a limit of that to make it zero. So can you see how to do that? You take p over to infinity. So you can't really do anything with the scale factor because that's something that's given to us. We cannot change it. But if we take the limit where p goes to infinity, then the Lagrangian certainly will go to zero. So let's see what happens when we do that. So we achieve this by taking p goes to infinity. So if we take p goes to infinity, well, first of all, if we look at the previous equations, we see that dt d tau goes to infinity, and that's just saying once more that d tau goes to zero. So the limit of this equation is not informative. The limit of that equation also is not informative. But if we look at the other equations that we got, well, this one right here, the limit where p goes to infinity is informative, because when p goes to infinity, we cancel out the p's here, and we pick up the rest, which is 1 over a. So in the limit, t remains useful as a parameter, but the equation for x becomes that. And it's a very simple equation, and there's really no trouble dealing with that equation. So in the limit of null geodesics, x dot goes to 1 over a, and certainly that will make the Lagrangian go to 0. And in that limit, kappa, which is written where? It's written up here. Again, in the limit, we get something simple, because in the limit, we cancel out this factor over here, and we get a dot over a. And that is the complete description of the null case when we take the limit. Again, no problem taking a limit, and that's a valid description of the null geodesic. But of course, we inherit the fact that the parameterization of the geodesic is not affine, because even at the limit, kappa doesn't go to 0. You have a question?
Well, we were talking about the limiting case as the speed approach to the speed of light. Wouldn't that be x dot goes to c? And then, well, we sort of like were able to describe why l should go to 0. But at first, I was thinking we'd let x dot go to c.
Yeah, so the question was, what do you mean by taking the speed of the observer to approach the speed of light? What does define the limit to the null case? And the suggestion was that perhaps what you should mean is that x dot should tend to c, or 1 in our units, instead of 1 over a. So, and that's a very good question, because it's a good excuse to remind ourselves that in general relativity, you have to be very careful with the interpretation of coordinates. And when you talk about speed in particular, and velocities and parameter in particular, you might mean a number of different things. You might mean coordinate velocities like these guys, but coordinate velocities refer to coordinate systems, and they don't have meanings that are, you know, invariant under coordinate transformations or anything like that. So they don't in themselves really mean an awful lot. You can talk about velocities in more physical terms. For example, you can be here in your expanding universe, and you can see a particle pass by, and you can, the observer, measure the speed of that particle as measured by you in terms of your own proper time. That's a well-defined measure of velocity, and it's always good in relativity to think in those terms. Try to think of specific measurements that are made by specific observers, and try to always relate things that may have physical meaning to things that can be measured. And here I was using those words very loosely, which we have to do if we're going to survive, because I cannot always say the fine print associated with all those phrases, but you're certainly right to call me on that. So when I meant taking the limit to the null case, really the operational meaning of taking the limit is taking the limit where the Lagrangian, or the space-time distance along the curve, approaches 0. It does not correspond to dx dt going to 1 or to c, because it just, you know, in that coordinate system, it just doesn't work out like that. And therefore, you have to be very careful at how you say things, which I'm not, and you have to be very careful how you interpret things that I say ambiguously. And unfortunately, that's sort of part of the game in this field. So we have to sort of speak loosely from time to time, because it would take too long to say it exactly. But it's very important to understand that when I said something like taking the speed of the observer to reach the speed of light, what I really meant to say is this. This is completely unambiguous and precise. Saying that x dot would approach 1 or the speed of light is not very meaningful, because it's really tied to a coordinate system. So thank you for calling me on that. Okay. So the last point I want to make about this is the fact that here we have successfully defined the null case by a limiting procedure. So there was really no obstacle in doing that, because we had chosen a parameterization that was not tied to proper time, that was not an affine parameterization. But now I want to do the next bit, which is to show that even here we can still redefine the parameterization of our null geodesic and make it affine, because, you know, I gave you the transformation law between the non-affine parameter t and the affine parameter lambda. So we can apply this and see what we get. So the transformation to an affine parameter lambda star, well, is going to be given by the general equation that I wrote down before, but now we can calculate all the ingredients. So d lambda star dt in this case is equal to the exponential of the integral in terms of t of kappa as a function of t prime over t prime. So we've just calculated kappa, so kappa is a dot over a. So what do we get? Well, for example, so let me evaluate the integral first. So kappa is a dot over a dt. Well, that's in fact pretty easy to integrate because I can just change the integration variable. A dot dt is just dA. So what we have here is the integral of dA over A, which is just log A. And the exponential of log A is A. And therefore, what we find is that d lambda star dt is simply A of t. And that tells us then that lambda star is obtained by integrating the scale factor. And, well, I don't know what the integrated scale factor is in terms of physical, that's what I meant before. I mean, this is what you get. This is the new parameter that would be an affine parameter, but I'm not sure what kind of physical meaning you would assign to that integrated scale factor. T is cosmic time. For me, it's more intuitive than the integrated scale factor, which, well, I know what it is. I can calculate it, but I don't, well, know what more I could say about this. But anyway, once you're here, you can certainly rewrite the equation for the null duties in terms of that new parameterization. So for example, d lambda star, well, we have it, it's 1 over a, and dx d lambda star would be given by, well, dx dt times dt d lambda star, and therefore it would be given by 1 over a squared. So those would be the components of the tangent vector to a null geodesic that is being described by an affine parameter, that's being described in terms of an affine parameter. Again, it gives you a description that's a little bit more cumbersome than the original one because, you know, here you have a set of two differential equations that involve a new variable lambda star, whereas before you had the complete description over here, and that's an equation you can really easily integrate if you know what the scale factor is as a function of time. So, I think you've seen all the points. So I think, you know, hopefully I've made a good case that sometimes it's good not to stick to affine parameterization. There's some good reasons to do that, and we're going to see other cases of that later on in the course. The limit to null case can be done if you don't have an affine parameterization. The limit is singular if you stick to affine parameterization. But once you've taken the limit, you can find a new parameter which is affine, even for null geodesics. And that affine parameter in the null case is completely unrelated to proper time. There's no, you know, so there's no relationship. Here's what it is in this case. And finally, while we see that the description in terms of the affine parameterization is, you know, not that difficult to deal with, but more complicated than the original one. And again, that's the case that I would rather stick with that one instead of this one. You have a question? Well, here what you could do to complete the exercise, so the question was, how do you recognize that this is, you know, the components of a tangent vector that would be written in terms of an affine parameter? Well, there's one test that I can write down right now. In fact, it's good that you asked the question because I forgot to mention that this morning. There's one property of the, well, it was sort of discussed, but only implicitly. No, what I was about to say is actually irrelevant. So the real test to check that this is really an affine description is calculate the second derivatives, substitute into the geodesic equation, and check that the right-hand side is zero. If you were to do it here, of course, you would get something non-zero. If you're doing it here, and you know that's an exercise I'm going to leave for you to do. If you check, you know, if you calculate the second derivatives from here and substitute into the geodesic equation, you will verify that the right-hand side is zero, and you will conclude that the parameterization was affine. So let me just write this down. So to check that this is really affine. And by the way, that's how you derive this expression for the change of parameterization. That's how you work it out. So to check that lambda star is affine, calculate d squared t d lambda star squared, and also d squared x d lambda star squared, and substitute in the geodesic equation and verify that the right-hand side is zero. Calculate this, substitute in the geodesic equation, and then check that the right-hand side is equal to zero. It's not a difficult exercise, but it will certainly be a good test and a good check that what I've told you is actually true. Okay, any questions about that? What I wanted to say before, and it's actually not relevant for the null case, is would be relevant for the time-like case, and that has to do with the fact that if I use proper time as a parameterization, then the length of the tangent vector is actually a constant, right? So, running out of chalk. Oh, there's more. So in the time-like case, U alpha is defined to be dx alpha d tau. And the length of that vector in space-time is what I get when I use the metric on the tangent vector. And when you do the calculation on the numerator, you get the space-time distance. In the denominator, you get proper time squared. But proper time squared is by definition minus the space-time distance, which means that the length of the vector in space-time is constant. So you get a constant length for your tangent vector when you use an affine parameterization. If you were to use a non-affine parameterization, well, that relationship would be spoiled, and you would find that that constant vector, that tangent vector is no longer of constant length. So that would be another way of verifying, but in a time-like case, whether or not your parameterization is affine. In the null case, it doesn't work because this is zero regardless. So the length of the vector, the tangent vector in the null case, is always zero. So that's no longer so useful. Other questions? Okay, or is it really 10 to 5? Oh, we're good to 5:30, okay, good. Okay, I wanted to talk about Lie derivatives. So that's section 4. And I want to say something about this because, first of all, it's a very useful tool in GR, and I'll go into that when I've discussed what it means, probably for the next half hour or something like that. And because it's so useful, because it's so important, I really wanted to be sure that you understand the geometrical meaning of the Lie derivative, in terms of very basic differential geometry. the nice thing, an interesting property of Lie derivatives. So in the morning, I made a big deal out of the fact that if you want to differentiate a vector, you have to introduce a connection. Otherwise, you would be stuck. You would not be able to compare vectors at different points on the manifold. The Lie derivative is, in fact, the way out. There's a way of defining the derivative of a vector without introducing a connection. And for that, you know, just for differential geometry reasons, it's an interesting notion, but it turns out also to be useful for all sorts of purposes in GR. So the idea, so let me write down what it is. So there's a notation for this. So there's a derivative operator that's a curly L, so a curly L for Lie. Lie is that famous French mathematician who invented that. So this is a Lie derivative in the direction of a certain vector, which is going to be a tangent vector to a curve. And what I want to define is, the Lie derivative of a vector A alpha that would be defined on a curve in the direction of that curve. And I just want to write down what the answer is before I tell you where this is coming from. And the rule to calculate a Lie derivative is that you calculate the ordinary derivative of the tensor in the direction of the curve, something which I told you was not tensorial in the morning. And sure enough, this is not tensorial, but the left-hand side will be tensorial because there's an added piece to that, which comes with a minus sign and which involves the derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of the A vector. So the claim is that, individually, those pieces are not tensorial, but the combination is. And one way of convincing you of this is to rewrite this in terms of covariant derivatives. So you replace this with a semicolon, and you add a Christoffel symbol term. You do it here too. And you just notice that the Christoffel terms actually cancel out. So you can write it like this, which emphasizes the fact that the operation does not involve the connection and therefore is defined independently of the connection. Or you can write it in terms of semicolons, which sort of hides that fact, but now emphasizes the fact that even though this doesn't look tensorial, it is tensorial by internal cancellation. So that's a new way of defining the derivative of a tensor. And as I said, the interest from purely differential geometry comes from the fact that this is something that exists on a manifold without having to introduce a connection, which means that you can actually differentiate vectors without introducing that rule for parallel transport and doing it purely in terms of quantities, without introducing any additional structure on a manifold. So that's kind of interesting. So what is the Lie derivative? Well, it involves two pieces. And you have the piece that you would expect is really the information you want to have, that is the derivative of the vector in the direction of the tangent vector in the direction of the curve. That looks intuitive. But there's the added piece, and that means that, in fact, we have to do a little bit more in order to define this, because what you have here is the derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of the vector field. So let's think about what this means. So what's the picture? Well, we have the manifold. We have the curve on the manifold. We have a tangent vector on the manifold, on the curve. So that's the picture for the tangent vector u, which is always tangent to the curve. We have a vector a, which may or may not point in the direction of the curve. In general, it will point in the direction away from the curve. This makes sense because a might be defined as a vector field on the curve, and all I'm doing here is to differentiate the vector field on the curve in the direction of the curve. But here I'm doing something else because I'm asking about the derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of the vector, which means that I'm thinking of calculating a derivative away from the curve. And that's something that would not be defined if I only had one curve and a tangent vector field simply on one curve. I can differentiate vector fields on one curve along the curve, but I cannot differentiate away from the curve if I have only that. So if all I do is to introduce one curve on the manifold, there's no way I can define something like this, because here I need information about how u spills over away from the curve. If I'm going to be differentiating in directions away from the curve, I need to know what the vector field is away from the curve. So even though the operation that I'm defining here is very simple and does not involve a connection, it's still fairly intricate because now I have to think of not just introducing one curve, but introducing a whole lot of them. Why is that? Well, U is supposed to be a tangent vector. If I have one curve, I have a tangent vector on one curve, but if U is supposed to be defined away from that one curve, well, if it's going to continue to be defined as a tangent vector, it's got to be tangent to other curves than just this one. And the bottom line is that if you want to define Lie differentiation, you have to define it in terms not only of one curve, but in terms of a whole network of curves. And later on, I'll use the word congruence to describe this network of curves. So to motivate where this is coming from, what I'm going to do is to generalize the picture. There's going to be that one curve that we're really interested in, but there's going to be a whole set, you know, there's going to be curves in the neighborhood of that one curve, and we're going to need those in order to define Lie derivative operator. So this is where I want to go with that. So to define the second term in the operation, we need to introduce more than one curve. So let me draw a picture. And in your notes, it should be fairly big because it's going to become a little bit busy as we keep going. So this is the reference curve, the one that we started with its tangent vector already defined. I need to know how the tangent vector behaves away from the curve, and the tangent vector will remain tangent to other curves as we go away from that one curve. So bottom line is that I need to have curves on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side of that curve. So what you have to imagine here is that we have a whole sequence of curves, you know, that spill away from that one curve. So here's another one. So, and then there's a whole bunch in between, and I won't draw them. So now instead of one curve, we have a whole network of curves, and we're going to need a description for all of those curves. So for example, what I'm going to do is to introduce a label. So this preferred curve is going to be, you know, denoted gamma, but now I'm going to assign a label to that preferred curve, and the label is going to have the value 0 on that one curve. And this is going to be, you know, some other curve that will have a label. I think in my notes I call it mu. So what we have here is a network or a congruence of curves. They're all time-like curves in my mind, so they could be space-like, it doesn't matter. They could be null, it doesn't matter. And in fact, I can do all of this without even thinking of a metric, so I really don't care about the signature of the curve. So we have a network of curves labeled by mu, and mu equals 0 is our, you know, curve of interest, but now we have a whole bunch of them, and mu is a running parameter, so we go from 0 to some finite value mu as, you know, we go from to the right of the curve, and then, you know, there would be curves on the left and all of that stuff. So now we have the vector field over here, the tangent vector field over here. And we also have a tangent vector field over here. So having done this, then we have the possibility of defining the second term. Okay, so what are we trying to do? We're trying to come up with a notion of derivative, which means that we're really trying to compare the value of two vectors here and here. So I've drawn the tangent vector. Let me draw the vector field A that we're trying to differentiate. And that's going to be our point P. And I'm going to draw a point Q over here. And at Q, well, we have the tangent vector field at Q, and we have the tangent vector field at Q, the other vector field at Q. So this is A alpha defined at P. This is A alpha defined at Q. And of course, there's no way of comparing directly A at Q from, you know, with A at P. They live in different vector spaces. There's no way we can compare them. A is defined only on the curve. I don't need to define it anywhere else. And you can see above that in the equation, the derivative of A is defined only along the curve. That term over here only involves the value of A on the curve, so I don't really need to think about extending A as a vector field away from the reference curve. Okay. Well, what are vectors fundamentally in differential geometry? They're tangent to curves. So what I'm going to do to keep going with this and you know, develop this notion is to imagine that A is actually tangent to a curve that would link this reference curve to that one over here. So here we have the, you know, fundamental curves, and now I'm going to draw another set of curves, which I'm going to call the cross curves. And those cross curves are going to be tangent, you know, the first one I'm going to draw is going to be tangent to A. You know, A is going to be tangent to that curve. So let me draw them, I want to connect those two points for some reason. So it's not drawn very well, but the point is that I want to make sure that this curve has A as a tangent vector, and I'm just continuing the curve so that it will cross over here. Why do I do that? Well, let me say a little bit more, and then I'll explain why I'm doing that. What I'm going to do is to use the cross curve. So here I've introduced a curve to which A is tangent. The curve will intersect the reference curve and that other curve over here, gamma zero and gamma mu. And what I'm going to do is to just, you know, in the construction, make sure that if the value of the parameter at P is lambda, the value of the parameter on this curve at that point is also going to be lambda. That's really not a problem. If it were not equal to lambda, I could just slide the parameter, redefine its origin, and I would make it so. So there's really no, you know, big, you know, obstacle in doing that. So P, by definition, is going to be the point on the curve, the first curve, the time-like curve that's going to be labeled by lambda. The cross curve is going to be intersecting the other curve also at parameter lambda by construction. I just assign a value lambda for the parameter on that curve. Okay, well, that's just drawing a picture, but now we're in good shape, because what I'm going to be insisting on is that, well, this cross curve is a curve that actually links those two curves at equal values for those parameters. What I'm going to do is to take this cross curve and I'm going to slide it up. Q is the point which is labeled by lambda plus d lambda. It's, you know, it's an incremental value away from the first point. Once I fix the parameterization here, I can pick the point over here that's also going to be labeled by lambda plus d lambda. And in a sense, what I'm doing here is to take this cross curve and I move it up rigidly up here so that it, you know, the new cross curve is also going to link points with equal parameter values on those two curves. So here it is. So I have one cross curve over here, and I slide it up so that it will link those two points in exactly the same way that they were linking those points over here, link points with equal parameter values. And now I'm almost done, because given that this curve gave rise to that curve, this curve will have a tangent vector. And that tangent vector, well, it's going to be a new tangent vector that we haven't seen before. I'm going to call it A prime. Or let's call it AL. And AL is going to live at Q. And now you see what can be done. I could not compare A at Q with A at P. But what I've done by drawing those pictures and drawing the cross curves and doing all of that is to find a way to transport A at P to AL at Q. And I can compare AL at Q to the original A at Q. And the comparison is going to be the Lie derivative. So it's a bit intricate, but it's all very nicely defined in terms of geometry. You know, you just draw curves and that's essentially all that's involved. And the operation of Lie differentiation is simply that, well, you draw those cross curves. So this first cross curve is defined to be tangent to A. at p. You slide it up rigidly by moving it in both on both of those curves by equal amounts of parameterization. You have a different cross curve. There's a new tangent vector on that cross curve, which you just define that way. And now you have two vectors that live exactly at the same point. You can compare them. And the comparison between the two is going to define the lead derivative of the vector A. And when we work it all out, we're going to end up with that expression right there. Question?
Can you show that first cross line there?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And to actually determine where that line actually goes, do you not need some additional structure, like A as a vector field, the writing of the original vertical line there?
Right. So that's a very good question. So I fixed the position, yeah. I fixed the velocity at that point.
Yeah.
How do I know how to continue it all the way across? And the answer is that I don't. And the next answer is that I don't care. It doesn't matter. And the reason why it doesn't matter is that the ambiguity that I've introduced here would show up at second order in the incrementation d lambda. And because I'll retain only first order information in what I'm going to be doing next, all of those, so all the ambiguity, in fact, doesn't matter, is eliminated at the end of the day. But very good question. Okay, so I think now so we have the picture. All we have to do now is to translate that into mathematics, and I want to end up with what I had there. So let me now define what I mean by Lie differentiation. I gave you the result before, but I haven't defined what it is. So, the definition. The Lie derivative of a vector field in the direction of a curve to which u is tangent, the Lie derivative at p is the original vector field at q minus the constructed one at q. Divided by the increment. So it's a little bit funny because I'm defining the derivative at p in terms of information at q, but again, the distinction is not very important because I'm working to first order in the parameters. So in the limit, all the information that I work out at q, I could define this to be the Lie derivative at q, but it would really make no difference in the construction, so let's not worry too much about this distinction. So anyway, so that's the definition. So the Lie derivative of the vector at p is given not in terms of the derivative of the difference between the original vector field so it's not the difference between a at q and a at p. What I do instead is to fix a at q because it's given, and then I sort of transport a from p to q using this construction, a construction that requires the existence of that network of curves, but the transport rule in this case does not require the definition or the introduction of a connection, and therefore it's a way of transporting vectors that does not require connection. The price to pay is that now you have to introduce this additional set of curves, so it's not enough to have only one curve, you have to have a whole congruence in order to define these things. But essentially, that's the definition right here. And it's a valid definition, and it's a tensorial definition because you're comparing two vectors at the same point.
All right.
Yep?
So, question that you're moving, you've got a whole, any number of curves in between those two as well, and you're moving it along, you land along each of those as well. And
yep. That's right. So, yeah. So, if I wanted to make the picture even busier, I would introduce a whole set of curves in between, And the point is that those curves would be by design intersecting all of the curves at the same value of the affine parameter. Well, parameter, because here I haven't said, and I don't need to say that lambda is affine, lambda is an arbitrary parameterization. Okay, so I like this geometric picture for the Lie derivative. If you feel a little bit uncomfortable, there's an, in the notes I have an alternative way of thinking about this, which is more mathematical, more formal in terms of coordinate transformations. You can take your pick. I like this one. If I were to rewrite the book today, I would probably substitute this instead of what I have now. But anyway, you can read both versions and decide which ones you like. Okay, so now let's do, so now that we have the geometry of the thing all figured out, well, let's just do the math and let's verify that this definition really amounts to that result over there. So let me redraw the picture. So I have one set of curves, which are the sort of preferred curves to which U is tangent, and then I have the cross curves to which, well, which link the preferred curves or the, the fundamental curves at equal parameter values. So what we have is a parameter lambda that runs along each curve and label mu, which takes me across the curves, and I can think of mu as a parameter on the cross curves. And I can think of coming up with a description, mathematical description of this whole network of curves by telling you what the position, so the mathematical description of all those curves can be written as a function of two parameters. That's what I want to say here. There's a lambda and there's a mu parameter, and I can describe this whole network of curves simultaneously if I give you as a function of lambda and mu what the position of, what the position is. X alpha is going to be the position of each point on any one of those curves. So how does that work? Well, it's actually pretty simple, because if I want to describe this curve, for example, I say that mu is equal to a constant and I vary lambda. So I pick a value for mu, that means picking one of those curves. I let lambda vary, and that gives me the position on each curve as a function of lambda. So for each value of mu, I get the description of one curve. If I change mu, I get the description of the next curve, and so on and so forth. So I can read this expression as saying that, mu is a parameter, mu is a label for each curve, lambda is a parameter on that curve, and x as a function of lambda for each value of mu is the description of each one of those upwards curve. But I can turn this around, because in fact, I could now look at it the other way and say that if I want to describe the cross curves, all I have to say is that, well, lambda is going to be fixed on the cross curves because by construction, they meet at constant value of lambda everywhere over here. Mu is going to be varying along the cross curves. So now if I look at it the other way, and if I keep lambda fixed and vary mu, I have a description of the cross curves. Bottom line is that what I'm defining here by drawing those curves is a two-dimensional submanifold of my four-dimensional original manifold. And the two-dimensional manifold is essentially described or charted by those two parameter, which sort of play the role of, a two-dimensional coordinate system for that two-dimensional manifold. Okay, so I think you see the point. So here we have a neat, recognize the existence of this neat mathematical description for this whole network. And I'm introducing that here, but that's a construction that will come back many times in the course. So that sort of thing we're going to be doing a lot. Just draw a picture like this and then recognize that there's an equivalent mathematical description, or the mathematical description of this drawing is the position of each curve expressed in terms of two parameters. And we have two systems of curves, and we get each system, whether we treat this as a label and that as a parameter, or the other way around. Okay, well, what is u? U is going to be tangent to each one of those curves, and u is going to be what happens when mu is fixed and lambda varies. So one way of expressing this is to say that u is going to be what I get from those mathematical expressions if I vary only with respect to lambda, keeping mu fixed. And I can express the vector field mu as a partial derivative of x alpha with respect to lambda, and it's a partial derivative because it's understood that if I go along one curve, I keep mu fixed because mu is labeling that curve. So we've introduced mu as a tangent vector to those curves. I'm going to introduce a new tangent vector, which is going to be tangent to the cross curves. And it's going to be linked to A, of course, but it's not going to be equal to A. I'm going to call it something else. I'm going to call it N. N alpha is going to be tangent to the cross curves. And N alpha is going to be obtained in a very similar way by taking a partial derivative with respect to mu, keeping lambda fixed. And I know a couple of things. One thing that I know, so this was my original P. This was my Q. One thing that I know is that, well, A at P is defined in exactly the same way that it defined N. So therefore, A at P is the same thing as N at P. And by construction also, what I called AL before at Q is also what I've now defined to be N at Q. So N is the vector field that's everywhere tangent to the cross curves. And by construction, N is equal to A at P. And what I've drawn here, the transported value of A by sliding up in that rigid way here, AL, that constructed vector that I did over here, well, by construction, agrees with the tangent vector field to the cross curves at Q. Okay, well, now we're almost there. Just need to do a couple of very simple steps. U and N are defined by taking first partial derivatives. If I take the partial derivative of U with respect to mu, what do I get? Well, I get the second partial derivative of x with respect to mu and with respect to lambda. We know that we have, if we have smooth functions, the ordering of the partial derivatives is irrelevant. So I can rewrite this as the partial derivative in the opposite order. And if I have that, then I have the statement that the partial derivative of u with respect to mu is the same thing as the partial derivative of n with respect to lambda. So nothing very deep about this, but it turns out to be very important for our purposes. And what does it mean? Well, I can rewrite this in different terms. I can say that this is the derivative of the vector field in the direction of the cross curves. That's what it is. And therefore, I can rewrite this partial derivative as follows. So taking a partial derivative of u with respect to mu, keeping lambda fixed, means that I'm differentiating the vector field in the direction of the cross curves. And I can re-express this as follows, because n is tangent to the cross curves. That's the derivative of u in the direction of the cross curves. So that's an equivalent expression for this. An equivalent expression for that, well, this is the derivative of n in the direction of lambda, which means that we're differentiating the vector field n alpha in the direction of u. And therefore, I can rewrite this as follows. And we have equality between those two things, which means that the construction that I've made here is one that guarantees that the vector fields that I've defined obey this property right here, which is essentially just a fancy way of writing the equality between partial derivatives, second partial derivatives. Okay. Well, now we almost have everything we need. Okay, now I want to go back to the definition up here. That definition right there. And I want to essentially express all the terms there in terms of what they stand for in terms of that picture that I've just drawn. So A alpha of Q, well, what is that? If I express the vector field as a function of lambda, A alpha of Q is the same thing as, how do I want to write this? So let me call P. So the if I say that the coordinates of P is going to be x alpha, then I can say that the coordinates of Q are going to be x alpha plus dx alpha. So what I wanted to say here is that A at Q is something that can be expressed in terms of the coordinates which are displaced relative to P. And all I want to say is that, well, this is something that I can express in terms of the Taylor expansion, in terms of the derivative of the vector field, all evaluated at P times the displacement in the coordinates. And here I'm truncating everything to first order. So I am expressing the vector at Q in terms of the vector at P by doing just a very straightforward Taylor expansion. So A at Q can be expressed in terms of A at P plus a derivative times the displacement. But here we're, of course, doing a displacement in the direction of the curve. And that's something that I can express in terms of U beta times d lambda. So the dx alpha, the dx beta over here is something that can be expressed in terms of U beta d lambda, because it's understood that we're displacing ourselves along the curve. So I'm using that equation right here. This is non-tensorial, of course. So I'm not doing anything properly tensorial at this stage. But let's get going. Now I have AL at Q. What is that? Well, by construction, this is the vector N evaluated at Q. And that's also something I can express as a Taylor expansion away from P. So that's going to be N at P plus the derivative of N in the direction of the curve times d lambda. What's N at P? It's A at P. This, by the equation I have over there, is the same thing as U alpha differentiated in the direction of N. We put it all together and we get our result. What's the Lie derivative of A in the direction of U? Well, it's the difference between those quantities right there. So we have A at P plus the derivative of A d lambda minus A at P minus the second term d lambda, all of that divided by d lambda. And of course, we're taking the limit where d lambda goes to zero. Those terms cancel out, and we end up with exactly the equation that I wrote down before. So that, which could have been just postulated out of thin air, would give us the a definition for the Lie derivative. In fact, it's something that can be motivated by just drawing geometrical figures. And the essential geometrical idea here is, the one that you cannot distinguish anymore from this, but essentially just about drawing cross curves and constructing a whole network of curves like this, and then coming up with a mathematical description of all of this. And once you have that, once you have the figure, once you have the geometrical picture, that is just something that you can do on top. That's just doing the mathematics of it. But, you know, once you've done all that, everything follows very easily. So you have this fundamental definition, you have the math, and then you have the, you know, the bottom line result that tells you that you can calculate the Lie derivative by calculating the vector field, the derivative of the vector field, but also calculating the derivative of the tangent vector field in the direction of A. So here, there's one step that I was missing because n here, n, the vector n is actually the same thing as A because everything is evaluated at P. So I could have made the substitution here. So let's see. So I think we run out of time. So there are two things here that you should pay attention to. First of all, this sort of geometrical construction that I just made here is something that I'll repeat. I mean, we're going to look at that in different contexts, you know, a few times. So this is something, you know, this is something that will come back to us. And it's a rather useful, powerful technique to get us started in a calculation like this. So the purpose of doing all of this was not just to talk about Lie derivatives in some great depth, but it was also to introduce those geometrical elements that will come back, you know, in some other sections of the course. But the other point, of course, was to introduce the Lie derivative in some depth with some geometrical, you know, intuition about it. And the reason for that is that, as I said before, the Lie derivative is going to be a rather important tool. It's the notion of a derivative that will match what we would want to say about the invariance of a tensor under under a symmetry transformation. So, for example, if we want to say that the metric doesn't depend on time, we can say two things. We can say that if I write down the metric in terms of this time coordinate, the metric does not depend on the time coordinate. That would be a coordinate-dependent way of saying that the metric is time-independent. Another way of saying that, which would be better because it doesn't, you know, require the an explicit coordinate system, would be to say that the Lie derivative of the metric along a certain direction, that would be the vector field that corresponds to the time translation direction, would be zero. So a statement of invariance under symmetry transformation is something that's expressed in terms of a Lie derivative. And if we know one thing in physics is that, you know, symmetry transformations are hugely important to any sort of physical situation. If you have a symmetry, you have conserved quantities, you have all sorts of useful things associated with that system. And in GR, the proper way of expressing this is through the Lie derivative. I was hoping to get into that today, but that's not going to happen. But next time we're going to look into that. So the relationship between symmetry transformation and Lie differentiation is very important. And therefore, in GR, the Lie derivative is very important. So we'll come back to that next time. I think for the time being, we're done. So any questions about that? All right, so I'll see you next week.